Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth lobbed shots at the messenger.
You sit in your air-conditioned offices or up on Capitol Hill and you nitpick and you plant fake stories in the Washington Post about kill everybody.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Michael Loewinger. The bombshell story came out just as a brand new Pentagon press corps showed up for work.
They're pumped. Tim Pool said, you know, we're not investigative reporters, so just essentially signaling right from the start that they didn't intend to do investigative journalism.
Plus, a new documentary about Seymour Hersh, who's lurking in the Pentagon hallways during the Vietnam War, led to the scoop of a lifetime.
Instead of going to lunch with my colleagues, I would go find the young officers. Eventually, Army guys would start saying, well, you know, it's Murder Incorporated there.
It's all coming up after this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Russia is praising a newly released U.S. security document that makes quickly ending the war in Ukraine and improving relations with Russia among key foreign policy goals. NPR's Charles Means has more.
Speaking to state media, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow viewed the adjustments in U.S. strategic policy as positive and largely consistent with Russia's own vision of global affairs. The document removes mention of Russia as a strategic threat and instead criticizes U.S. allies in Europe for failing to tend to their own security. The paper also largely aligns with Russia in arguing European efforts to preserve Ukraine's territorial integrity are unrealistic. The paper's release comes as the White House says it's close to finalizing a deal to end Russia's nearly 4-year war in Ukraine, raising concerns in Kyiv and Europe that the U.S. and Russia are working together to force concessions on Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The suspect accused of planting pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol in 2021 told federal investigators he believed conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen from then-President Trump. He also expressed views supportive of Trump. And Piers Mara Eliason reports the account comes from a person familiar with the investigation who wasn't authorized to speak publicly.
For years, Trump supporters, including Dan Bongino, who is now the deputy FBI director, have claimed that the pipe bombs were an inside job. But the suspect was apparently a Trump supporter who told law enforcement that he believed the lie that Trump won the 2020 election. Speaking to Sean Hannity on Fox, Bongino explained why the facts are at odds with what he used to say as a paid podcaster.
I was paid in the past, Sean, for my opinions. That's clear. And one day I'll be back in that space. But that's not what I'm paid for now.
Now Bongino says, quote, I'm paid to be your deputy FBI director, and we base investigations on facts. Mara Eliason, NPR News.
Policymakers at the Federal Reserve meet this week to discuss interest rates, and they are expected to lower the benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point. And Pierce Scott Horsley reports.
The Fed lowered interest rates at each of its last two meetings, but policymakers were divided on whether a third straight cut would be warranted this coming week. Inflation still well above the Fed's 2% target, which would ordinarily suggest keeping rates higher. But the central bank's also concerned about a softening job market, which could be cushioned with lower interest rates. Investors think those job market worries will take priority at this week's meeting, and the rate-setting committee will opt for another quarter-point cut, but the decision is not likely to be unanimous. The 6-week government shutdown added to the uncertainty by delaying some key economic reports until after this week's meeting. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Rachel Vasquez. The San Francisco Sheriff's Deputy Association is calling for increased security at San Francisco General Hospital after a social worker who was allegedly stabbed by a patient died of their injuries yesterday. San Francisco Chronicle reporter Annie Vanstein says staff had raised concerns about the suspect weeks before the fatal incident.
Staff there had been putting in calls, asking for the situation to be escalated, and what we're hearing is that those pleas weren't taken seriously, or at least not seriously enough.
The Sheriff's Deputy Association says their union president objected to a plan in 2022 to reduce deputies at the hospital. The San Francisco Department of Public Health did not respond to a request for comment. An autonomous vehicle expert is calling incidents of Waymo cars passing stopped school buses a troubling pattern for the Bay Area-based company. Waymo says it's issuing a voluntary software recall related to the incidents early next week. Carnegie Mellon Emeritus Professor Philip Koopman has studied self-driving cars for three decades. He says it's alarming that Waymo allowed its cars to pass stopped school buses in Austin, Texas, 19 times.
Why did the school district have to complain and resort to what amounts to public shaming before Waymo would fix it?
Waymo did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but has said it moved quickly to address the issue and that no injuries occurred related to the recall. I'm Rachel Vasquez, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trust, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrust.org/afterthefact. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. Hazy sunshine today and high temperatures in the upper 50s to low 60s.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Michael Loewinger. On Thursday morning, the New York Times announced that it's suing the Pentagon.
The lawsuit names the Defense Department, Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell as the defendants.
The lawsuit seeks to repeal the new press policy, with the New York Times calling it a violation of free press's right to seek information under their First and Fifth Amendment rights.
The crackdown on the Pentagon press comes after almost a year of reports about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's fumbles and missteps. Most recently, a bombshell story surrounding the White House's deadly strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats.
The Washington Post has an exclusive. They say that Secretary Pete Hegseth gave an order to, quote, kill everybody in the first strike on suspected drug boats in the Caribbean back in September.
Now, after an initial strike on the vessel left two people alive and clinging to the burning wreckage of the boat, a second strike on the stricken vessel was taken in order to carry out Hegseth's wishes.
Since that first strike in early September, the U.S. has carried out at least 21 more, killing more than 80 people. There are serious questions about whether these attacks fall within the rules governing armed conflicts. But this second strike, which some are calling a double tap, raises yet more questions.
Now, the Post's article contains analysis from a former military lawyer named Todd Huntley, who says, quote, even if the U.S. were at war with the traffickers, an order to kill all the boat's occupants if they were no longer able to fight would in essence be an order to show no quarter, which would be a war crime, end quote.
And it gives me no pleasure to say what I'm about to say, because I worked with Pete Hegseth for 7 or 8 years at Fox News. This is an act of a war crime.
Former Fox talking head Andrew Napolitano speaking on the pro-Trump Newsmax.
Ordering survivors who the law requires be rescued instead to be murdered. There's absolutely no legal basis for it.
The White House's response has been muddled. The day of the attack, back in September, President Trump posted a video of the boat being struck the first time. The second strike had been redacted and made it sound like he was all over it.
We just, over the last few minutes, literally shot out a boat.
A day later, Defense Secretary Hegseth sounded equally in the know.
I watched it live. We knew exactly who was in that boat. We knew exactly what they were doing.
Then the Washington Post published its story on November 28th. Last Sunday, when asked about the story, President Trump told reporters,
"We'll look into it. But no, I wouldn't have wanted that, not a second strike. The first strike was very lethal, it was fine, and if there were two people around, but Pete said that didn't happen."
On Monday, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt drew attention to another guy.
With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes.
To clarify, Admiral Bradley was the one who gave that order for a second strike.
And he was well within his authority to do so.
So it sounds like there was a second strike. But was Admiral Bradley following Hegseth's instructions when he gave that order? And who knew about it?
Pete didn't know about a second attack having to do with two people.
President Trump at a cabinet meeting on Tuesday alongside Pete Hegseth. Later in that same meeting, Hegseth himself indicated he actually did know about the strike. He said that after watching the first one live, he left the room.
A couple of hours later, I learned that that commander had made the, which he had the complete authority to do, and by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
So you didn't see any survivors, to be clear, after that first strike?
I did not personally see survivors, but I stand, because the thing was on fire. It was exploded in fire and smoke. You can't see anything. You got digital. This is called the fog of war.
Which those reporters would understand if they just stepped outside once in a while.
You sit in your air-conditioned offices or up on Capitol Hill and you nitpick and you plant fake stories in the Washington Post about kill everybody, phrases on anonymous sources not based in anything, not based in any truth at all.
On Thursday, a handful of lawmakers saw the full video of the strike, including the portion where the two surviving men were killed. Democratic Congressman Jim Himes.
What I saw in that room was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service. You have two individuals in clear distress, without any means of locomotion, with a destroyed vessel, who were killed by the United States.
Dan LaMoth is one of those nitpicking journalists Pete Hegseth was berating this week. He contributed to the Washington Post reporting on the second strike, and until recently, he had a desk at the headquarters of the Department of Defense, where he covered the U.S. military and the Pentagon. In October, he and most of the press corps walked out. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, appreciate it.
You spent 12 years as a member of the Pentagon press corps, meaning that you had a desk in the Pentagon, you were credentialed to go to Pentagon press briefings and to speak with federal workers there. But you, alongside every other news organization in the building other than One American News Network, were kicked out in mid-October after you refused to sign an agreement that would restrict the kinds of reporting that you could do there. I want to ask you about that agreement and your decision not to sign it in a minute. But first, tell me about your last day at the Pentagon. How did it feel to just leave it all behind?
It had a kind of a surreal feel. And for me, it kind of came in waves this year. Back in March, they revoked the specific desk that the Washington Post had, along with several other outlets. So I cleaned out my desk way back then. But my last day was actually the day before you saw a lot of the other reporters walk out. Ironically, because I was asked to go up to New York City for a press freedom dinner with some other Washington Post people. So yeah, I had to turn in my badge, say my goodbyes. I took a photograph in front of the steps and the Department of Defense sign that was up at the time. And yeah, I haven't been back in the Pentagon since October 14th, 15th.
The rules around reporting there have been changing for a while. There were already areas of the building that you couldn't visit without an escort, right? I'd heard that maybe the McDonald's was off limits.
There have always been parts of the building that were off limits. The hallways are kind of common spaces, and then there are locks on many rooms in the building. And then there are places where we are openly welcome and invited. It would not be uncommon for me to walk 10 minutes to get to the Army, because you know the building's that big, and drop in on Army Public Affairs, or walk across the hallway and go see the Joint Staff. Like, there were places that had been sort of welcoming and accepted spots that the media would go. Over time this year, they had restricted those spaces, basically down to the office space, specifically where the press sat, the adjacent office where the public affairs officers, specifically for Hegseth's team, sat, and the briefing room when it was actually unlocked, which was rare because they didn't really brief. So you're kind of restricted down to 5%, 10% of the building. And as recently as a year ago, we probably had access to 70% of the footprint, something like that.
Why do you think they had been shutting off your physical access to so many of these spaces?
For a lot of years, we had people running the Pentagon from both parties who kind of often had spent time around it previously. There's sort of an expertise there. There's sort of a lived experience there where you're like, all right, I'm used to seeing a reporter around the corner when I'm in the hallway. And I think this team came in with a different set of experiences. They had not been around the Pentagon nearly as much, and they seemed to take exception right away to the idea that the media would be so co-located with them. And then I think on top of that, there have been really since the day Secretary Hegseth was first nominated and going forward, there were so many stories that were frustrating to him. And that goes back to the confirmation period where his own sexual assault allegations came up, his infidelity came up, his past drinking came up, and that all gets pushed into the limelight because you've been nominated for a cabinet position. You have to vet these people. He took the job quite angry at the media writ large, and in particular the media that had covered his confirmation. By March, you're dealing with Signalgate. By April, you're dealing with several staff members that he fired, accused of leaking. All these months later, there's no actual sense that they leaked classified information, which is what the allegation was publicly on television. And then you move into this weird spot of numerous people getting fired. All of those stories create churn. And then more recently, you're dealing with these strikes, which are obviously contentious in their own right. So it's just a whole calendar year at this point of challenging, difficult stories. The media is not the one that picks those stories. Those are events that are happening all in front of us, and it would be derelict for the media not to be covering those things.
But of course, shooting the messenger is just so easy. During your time at the Pentagon, how often would you get a good story, a good scoop, a good lead from just walking around and talking to people? Did that access translate to good journalism?
Being in the building was helpful for building relationships, which come in really handy on these contentious stories, by the way. When you actually know somebody and have talked about their kids playing Little League, and now you got to deal with a difficult story the following day, that helps. But rarely do you ever get pulled aside in a hallway and some big secret is spilled to you. There's times where they'll be like, hey, I might have something for you tomorrow. Just by virtue of being in the building, you're in the loop on things that they're already planning to roll out. But it's way more of that than it is state secrets getting handed out in line at the McDonald's.
Since you've all left the Pentagon, a crop of right-wing influencers have replaced you, the new so-called Pentagon Press Corps. And of course, these influencers signed that agreement from the Pentagon, limiting their access to different parts of the building, limiting their ability to do certain kinds of reporting in exchange for access to press briefings. Give me a little bit more information about what exactly they've agreed to.
The new restrictions that were presented to the traditional press corps came somewhat out of left field. There had been some thought that they might crack down again after the earlier restrictions on how freely you could walk in the unclassified spaces in the building. But when it actually came to us, for me, the challenge was, if you're asking me to sign up front an agreement that says I will not solicit information, and not only classified information, but basically anything nebulously stated as defense information, that could be virtually anything. It could be arbitrarily applied. It struck me as problematic, ethically and otherwise, as a journalist.
Basically, this said that if you solicited information from a Pentagon worker who was not authorized to speak, or information that was not authorized to be released, then you could lose access to the facilities.
You could lose access. There was also vague language in there that felt pretty threatening to sources as well, which is to say, if they spoke to you even about unclassified matters, let's say front office knife fights between the Hegseth team, like there was a lot of that sort of stuff this year as well, that could potentially get someone fired, prosecuted, disciplined. The concern was at least there that they were going to go after people that were just trying to explain what's actually happening. So I saw that as a concern. And I think the issue that wasn't lost on me as we looked at this, if you're going to tell me I can only get information that is coming through certain people authorized to speak, and then the people authorized to speak never brief, never answer a question with any kind of substance, where's that leave us?
What's the point?
With all that said, the job this year already had shifted a great deal. I spend more time on my phone in the evenings than I ever have because you're catching people when they're available. Tradecraft matters a great deal right now. I think you have to be careful with how you're speaking to people and protect your sources. You know, you soldier on, you deal with the job as it is.
What's it been like for you watching a group of internet famous right-wing influencers sit in your seat, begin calling themselves the Pentagon Press Corps after signing that agreement that you refused to sign?
I think the only thing that was surreal to the point of it being kind of a viral meme this week was multiple members of this new press corps all claiming to have the Washington Post desk.
Your old desk.
Right. And as I mentioned, I cleaned that desk out months ago.
Who said they had your desk?
I mean, Laura Loomer was the one that was probably most widely seen, but I mean, several other people all posted photographs saying they were sitting in the Washington Post desk.
so they were all assigned. They were all assigned the same desk. I don't understand.
I didn't really understand it either. I mean, I took it kind of as mockery or an attempt at trolling. It's cool. I'm doing my job. They want to spike the football. They can, but that's where we are.
You're working now outside the Pentagon. How has that affected the ability to do your job?
There are people who have specifically come to me this year and said, I don't talk to the media, but I can't believe what I'm seeing. And I want to talk to you about this specific subject. It's a unique moment where more people are inspired or inclined to speak up than normal. It used to be common to kind of see the media going back and forth on issues of the day on camera a couple times a week. It's not the be all end all, but it's a baseline. It's a starting point for what's happening. How a $1 trillion department with a couple million people on the taxpayer dime are doing their jobs. These operations can be dangerous. People do die in accidents, in firefights, and, you know, aircraft crashes. Like, so only talking about what they want to is never really going to be the answer, I think, for the majority of the media.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Lamoth covers the U.S. military and the Pentagon for The Washington Post. Coming up, we meet the new Pentagon Press Corps. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And by Progressive Insurance, where customers can compare prices on car insurance against different companies side by side to find a rate that works for them. Options to fit most any budget, more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air from NPR and WHYY. If you value thoughtful, in-depth interviews with interesting and influential people, please join others in supporting shows like Fresh Air with a gift to this public radio station in your will or retirement account. If you've already included public media in your plans, thank you. Trust in the future of public radio.
Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS, presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russia-Ukraine war. Now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app, awards eligible. And John Muir Health, delivering cardiac surgery with a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health.
Would you give up your chance to rule a country for love?
Girls are told from birth. We watch Disney movies. We're told that there's no greater thing than being a princess. But what is the actual reality of that?
Author and journalist Rebecca Armitage on how covering the British royal family helped inspire the heart of her debut novel, The Heir Apparent. I'm Miles Parks. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is coming your way at 5 o'clock this afternoon here on KQED News.
This is On the Media. I'm Michael Lowinger. On Monday, the Pentagon hosted an onboarding day for the brand new press corps. The new group of about 70 credentialed press, including Laura Loomer, a far-right activist known to consort closely with the president, James O'Keefe, founder of the far-right sting operation Project Veritas, Matt Gaetz, the disgraced lawmaker and former attorney general candidate accused of soliciting underage girls, Tim Pool, a far-right vlogger who inadvertently accepted Russian funding for his YouTube content, and outlets like Lindell TV, owned by the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, who lost a lawsuit brought by a former employee of Dominion Voting Systems for defamation over the 2020 election, and Gateway Pundit, a far-right conspiracy outlet, also still being sued by that same former Dominion employee. Anna Merlin covers extremism and conspiracy peddlers as a senior reporter at Mother Jones, so she's more than familiar with a lot of those people. She told me that just about everyone present in the Pentagon briefing room had happily agreed to the Defense Department's new policies.
They're pumped. When these new rules were first announced, people like Tim Pool, he essentially said, you know, we're not investigative reporters, so just essentially signaling right from the start that they didn't intend to do investigative journalism about the Pentagon or the Department of Defense. And others have said, you know, that these rules are reasonable and that, you know, the previous media in the building wouldn't agree to them just because they were biased against the president. It's what you would expect.
Of course, the reason we're speaking is that this is the week that the new press corps was welcomed to the Pentagon. The Pentagon's deputy press secretary, Kingsley Wilson, was the person who fielded questions from the new Pentagon Corps. You reported on Wilson herself earlier this year, calling her a, quote, overt internet troll with a long history of bigoted, xenophobic, and deliberately provocative posting. What did you mean by that?
Wilson is an interesting figure. She's the daughter of Steve Cortez, a longtime Trump advisor. She was 26 years old when she took the job. She's had a lot of different roles in the sort of MAGA internet ecosystem, and she spent a lot of time tweeting, a lot of tweets excoriating immigrants and trans people, advocating for what she called, quote, zero immigration and mass deportations, bemoaning the, quote, death of the West, the term that is often used by far-right activists. She has also made even more wild and bigoted claims, for instance, repeating debunked lies about the lynching death of Leo Frank, a Jewish man who was lynched and murdered in 1915 by a mob in Georgia.
She claimed that Frank was guilty for the murder that put him behind bars, something that most modern historians agree was a wrongful conviction. Just to sit on that for a moment, the fact that she's tweeted about this multiple times just raises for me the question, like, what waters is she swimming in that this is the stuff that occupies her attention?
It's pretty extraordinary. Claims specifically about Leo Frank are part of some of the sort of deepest and most obscure pool of specifically anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. They are absolutely rancid when they've been used to justify violence against Jewish communities, which is specifically pretty extraordinary because the Trump administration has cast themselves as a friend to the Jewish people, has put a lot of energy into supposed investigations of anti-Semitism on college campuses. So to install a press secretary in the Pentagon who had made these statements was in and of itself pretty wild. And then I and other news outlets and even some elected officials, you know, called on the Pentagon to respond to these comments, and they never did. Nothing happened.
In 2024, she tweeted, "The Great Replacement isn't a right-wing conspiracy theory, it's reality." Mm-hmm. And she posted this over a screenshot of a Bloomberg article about the growth of the U.S. Hispanic population. And here's a bit from her opening remarks for Tuesday's presser.
Legacy media chose to self-deport from this building. And if you look at the numbers, it's pretty clear why no one followed them. National trust in these mainstream media outlets has cratered to 28%, the lowest ever recorded. The American people don't trust these propagandists because they stopped telling the truth.
Yeah, using the phrase self-deport, which is, of course, a politically incredibly charged phrase that refers to the Trump administration's kind of ongoing practices of mass deportation is, yeah, again, a choice.
Tell me about the question that Matt Gaetz, former member of Congress, asked in the briefing.
His question is a really good sort of indication of what this new press corps means to do and his presence.
Kingsley, if Nicolas Maduro leaves Venezuela today, what role will the Department of War have in a post-Maduro Venezuela?
It was a question about regime change, positioned in a really supportive way.
And what sort of response did he get?
Well, so what was funny is he actually didn't get a particularly substantive response. Kingsley Wilson said, quote, "The department has a contingency plan for everything. We are a planning organization." So with all the access these folks have, you know, and with all the ideological similarities they have to the people running the Pentagon right now, they're still actually not able to get substantive or newsworthy answers to some of these questions.
I want to ask you about the question from Laura Loomer, because it was quite interesting.
Mm.
She asked about the conflicting plans to, on one hand, cozy up to Qatar at the same time that the Trump administration is attempting to label the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization.
Now that the president has started the process of designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign Islamic terrorist organization, will the Department of War still proceed with selling F-15 fighter jets to Qatar? And how will they be able to train Qatari pilots at their airbase in Idaho if Qatar is included in the designation?
It's not a bad question. I mean, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, specifically Loomer's role is going to be the most interesting one in the new Pentagon press corps. Loomer is a very longtime anti-Muslim activist. She is extremely vocal about that, often in the most inflammatory of ways. And she is well known to be a pretty key presence unofficially in the White House. You know, there is a verb, Loomered, which means someone getting thrown out of their job in the administration because Laura Loomer calls for it. And this has happened several times, right? So if there is any kind of oppositional force within the new Pentagon press corps, it might be her, but it's going to be her in the service of promoting conspiracy theories and anti-Muslim sentiments.
James O'Keefe, founder of Project Veritas, you said that he's at the helm of a new independent outlet bearing his name. Tell me about how he used his opportunity in the spotlight earlier this week.
So James O'Keefe separated from Project Veritas in a pretty ugly divorce, if you will, and now runs a company called O'Keefe Media Group. And his question was,
Nicholas Terza, branch chief here at the Pentagon, was caught on a video in the spring stating, quote, "Trump is illegitimate. We're going to resist him, quote, everything he does. We know there are other people like this that work here. My question is, what steps is the Department of War taking to identify and address personnel who are in the self-described resistance movement?"
So basically, that's O'Keefe asking how they're going to ferret out perceived disloyalty within the Defense Department.
Yes, purging government employees for, I guess, constitutionally protected speech.
Correct.
About the government.
Project Veritas used selectively edited undercover videos to present unflattering portrayals of, for instance, people who work for Planned Parenthood, people who worked in the Biden administration. O'Keefe has spent a lot of time trying to show that people involved in Democratic politics, involved in things like George Soros's Open Society Foundation, are in some way working against the interests of the American people, I think would be the safest way to put that.
A couple more new names that we might be hearing from the Pentagon. Wade Searle, who covers media for LifeSite News, a Canadian far-right Catholic advocacy outlet, asked this question.
So you were speaking earlier about the Washington Post report concerning the Secretary of War and Admiral Bradley. And my question is, does the Department of War plan on pursuing any sort of legal action against the Washington Post? And what consequences will there be for lying to the American people?
Yeah, again, it was a very warm and fuzzy exchange between the members of the new press corps and the Pentagon, designed to set up, you know, monologues about attacking the previous administration and traditional news outlets like the Washington Post. But in a way, the press conference itself was kind of beside the point. It didn't produce a lot of news. It was actually remarkably boring. What a lot of these folks did with most of their first day in the Pentagon was take pictures of themselves at desks that were previously occupied by mainstream news outlets. It seemed kind of clear that that was the point, declaring themselves kind of victorious over the old media, and that was it.
All these outlets and personalities that now have credentials, these are people who have built brands over many years around conspiracy theories about, you know, shadowy government plots. It is sort of tying my brain in knots watching these people, in exchange for access to press briefings, agree to not attempt to uncover government secrets. Like, isn't that their bread and butter, that we're being lied to?
Yeah, it is super interesting, especially for people who are part of, you know, what I would call like the conspiracy media ecosystem. For years, they have set themselves up as adversarial to the U.S. government, have suggested, you know, that there is a deep state within the government that is working against the American people, you know, that might be, depending on how far in the deep end of the pool they are, like actively trying to kill all of us in various ways. And, you know, here they are praising the Pentagon, praising the presidential administration, and yeah, agreeing to sign these rules that most reasonable people read and interpreted as agreements not to do investigative work. And so for me, there is a real question about how their audiences will respond. You know, people who are distrustful of government, people who might be distrustful of politicians in general, how they're going to feel about these outsider media outlets agreeing to take on a really, really, really different role. I'm super curious if this works for them to maintain their audience.
You've been tracking a lot of these conspiracy theorists, far-right content creators, some of these people who are now asking and answering questions in the Pentagon. For you, somebody on this beat, how does it make you feel?
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's super normal. No, I'm sorry. So I have a few questions. For instance, I am very curious if they continue showing up to work.
When the thrill wears off, like, do they really want to do this job?
Yeah, I mean, it can be, you know, quite boring. I think any journalist who's ever sat through a press conference, you know, a public meeting, like it's hard work. And so, yeah, I'm super curious if they keep showing up. I'm super curious how they figure out how to define themselves in relation to the Trump administration. So many of these people and these outlets have positioned themselves as explicitly pro-Trump, have depicted him as a heroic outsider who's coming back to save America. These great disclosures and these huge changes and these consequential secrets that they are claiming are going to be revealed, you know, presumably it's all going to come out now. So I'm curious what holding the Trump administration accountable looks like for them.
Anna, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Merlin is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering disinformation, tech, and extremism. Coming up, a new documentary about a journalist who once loomed large in the halls of the Pentagon. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos in a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And by Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain, 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at SEED.com/public.
Support for KQED comes from Rising Team, creator of Supermanager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills, practice hard conversations, and strengthen team performance. Learn more at supermanager.ai. And Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. I'm Beth Huizinga. We have something new this afternoon, and we'll be going forward at 3 o'clock Sunday afternoons.
This week on the Sam Sanders Show, legendary costume designer Ruth E. Carter. From Malcolm X to Sinners, she built the look of Black Hollywood.
I see, you know, a young Black girl in there pulling for her show. I feel like I've had something to do with that.
You have.
And I'm welcoming that.
Ruth E. Carter on costuming Sinners, Black Panther, and also Seinfeld.
The Sam Sanders Show coming your way 3 o'clock Sunday afternoons. Planet Money and How I Built That. Built this, that will be at 9 o'clock this evening. And the TED Radio Hour, that's at 4 o'clock this afternoon. TED speakers share ideas about how to help you get grounded and even follow your bliss all at the same time.
This is On the Media. I'm Michael Lowinger. To round out this hour about reporting on the U.S. military and the Department of Defense, we go back in time to the 1960s. It's the height of the Vietnam War, and a young investigative journalist named Seymour Hersh starts attending Pentagon press briefings and finds them pretty damn silly.
around 10:30 to come and give you a little briefing, you file a little something off that. You know, these guys get paid, you know, an awful lot of money for doing things like listening to the news conference and waiting an hour till the transcript's typed up, and then writing a 500-word story off it.
What Hirsch did instead was slip into the hallways of the Pentagon, and that's how he got the scoop of a lifetime.
Instead of going to lunch with my colleagues, I would go find the young officers. You know, talk a little football and get to know them. I had been in the Army. I was in the Army Reserves. Eventually, Army guys would start saying, well, you know, it's Murder Incorporated there. Well, I said, what do you mean?
Hirsch went on to become one of the most famous, complicated, and embattled reporters of the latter half of the 20th century after exposing several government cover-ups, earning the begrudging admiration and ire of presidents and their top advisors.
This fellow Hirsch is a son of a bitch.
President Nixon speaking in his White House tapes.
Well, you know, he's probably a communist agent. Exactly.
Laura Poitras, an award-winning journalist and filmmaker whose documentaries include Citizen Four and All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, together with her co-director Mark Obenhaus, filmed over 100 hours of interviews with Hirsch for a soon-to-be-streaming Netflix documentary called Cover Up. I asked her why she wanted to make a film about Cy Hirsch, and why now?
I first approached Cy in 2005, motivated by some similar concerns that I have today, which is the state of investigative journalism and the importance of investigative journalism to expose government wrongdoing and state power. I made a film about the occupation and war in Iraq, and right before I traveled to Iraq is when Cy published his extraordinary reporting on Abu Ghraib prison and torture. The source of my film started there. I came back from Iraq and I was still obsessed with both Cy's reporting and the failure of legacy media in the quote-unquote war on terror. Cy was really gracious. He invited me to his office. I sort of joke that the Twilight music should have started playing when you walk into his office because you were like going back decades in time. And there were like stacks of notebooks everywhere and tennis rackets and complete chaos. And he was gracious and wonderful and funny and prickly. He talked to me for a long time and then he ultimately said, no way, you know, it's not going to happen. So I didn't ever let go of the idea and we stayed in touch over the years. He followed the reporting I did around NSA surveillance and Edward Snowden, and I think he recognized I was a bit of a kindred spirit. I should say with Cy, like to his great credit, once he was in, he was all in, despite his discomfort with some of the process.
And I definitely want to get into his discomfort with the process, but first I want to kind of dive into who he is as a journalist and how he got his start. One of the earlier scenes in the film is of a much younger Cy Hirsch at a Pentagon press conference while he's employed at the Associated Press. During the lunch break, while all the other reporters are like socializing, he slips into the hallway and chats up officers. One of them tells him, quote, "We are in a stage of open murder in Vietnam." Another says, well, it's Murder Incorporated there. So he says, Murder Incorporated? Like, what?
Yep.
Tell me what happens next.
He just gets a tip. And the tip is that there's someone being court-martialed. He doesn't know anything more. And then we start to put the pieces together. He learns then his name is Callie. He meets the lawyer. He tracks him down at Fort Benning. And learns about this massacre that we now know is the My Lai massacre, where the U.S. military went into a village of civilians and murdered over 500 people, including babies. And what obsessed Cy was, how is this possible? And he didn't want to leave the story at just looking at the soldiers, but what was the chain of command? So what he eventually uncovers is that there was a policy to bring body counts. Westmoreland, who was then running this war, needed dead bodies. And so they went and slaughtered this village. It took over a year for the story to break. So a lot of people knew about this massacre. And then Cy got the tip.
He wonders who else in the press might have known about this.
Exactly.
And sat on it.
Yeah, he's convinced that many people knew.
After he breaks the My Lai story, Hirsch got a job at the New York Times, where he covered Watergate and the CIA's operation of spying on thousands of college students, domestic anti-war activists. He began to loom so large in Washington as a sort of muckraker that even Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's national security advisor, took notice.
I go see him in the White House, and he said, so I'm interested in what your impression was of when you were in Hanoi in all those weeks. I said, well, I can tell you I saw no signs of a lack of morale. And I went on like that. 10-15 minutes of badinage. He said, hold on. And he called his aide on Vietnam, and he said to him, this man knows more about what's going on in Vietnam than the CIA. And I thought to myself, this can't be real. I mean, am I supposed to be flattered by this? I was just amazed.
So clearly, whatever sort of magic he was trying to work on Hirsch, it didn't work.
It didn't work. And, you know, before I showed up, Kissinger was kind of having his way. He would be this anonymous source to the Times. He would feed stories, and but not under his name. Tsai was having none of it. And I think Kissinger knew that having Tsai Hirsch at the New York Times was not going to be good for him. And it wasn't good for him. I mean, Tsai developed an obsession with Kissinger, and he was assigned to do Watergate after Woodward and Bernstein had been running with the story for 7 months, and then Tsai ended up publishing a lot of stories about Watergate, focusing on Kissinger. But somehow Kissinger always managed to get away with it, right? Nixon has to resign, but like Kissinger stayed on, and he was somebody who was managed to stay in power for almost his entire life.
Tsai Hirsch is a big reason that the New York Times even started reporting on the Watergate scandal. It seems like he had a great career there. Why did he decide to leave?
He's somebody who's always had some friction with his editors. He did this big investigative reporting on a corporation, Gulf and Western, which is a story he partnered with Jeff Gerth on, and they exposed a lot of corporate wrongdoing. His relationship with his editor shifted, that they became very nervous about the story, that all of a sudden talking about corporate power and money didn't make the Times comfortable, and he got a lot of pushback.
He said something in your film to the effect of, the New York Times is a part of the corporate world, and it's not comfortable scrutinizing the corporate world.
Yeah, and in the course of the reporting, Jeff Gerth decided to look into the financial records of the Times and their corporate filings, and discovered that the executive editor, Abe Rosenthal, had gotten a loan to buy an apartment at a discount, and he got it through the board. And so then they had to confront their boss about this favorable loan, because they were working on a story that was dealing with executives getting favorable loans. So it kind of created a bit of a blowout. When we were editing, we had a big storyboard, because we needed to see, sort of have like a visual, how do we hold all of Tsai's stories in one place? And so we had this big board, and there was oftentimes like Tsai quits, like Tsai quits the AP, Tsai quits the New York Times, Tsai quits. And then at some point it was like Tsai quits the movie. You know, it's a pattern.
Another outlet that he worked at for some time and made an impact on was The New Yorker, which was home to his reporting into Abu Ghraib.
After 9/11, he wanted to understand, how did this happen?
How did they not see 9/11 coming?
Yeah. The more that we know, the more of a failure we know it to be, because the CIA knew the hijackers had entered the country and didn't inform the FBI. But then the lead up to the Iraq War, and I think that just really set Tsai off, because he knew very well that there was no connection between the 9/11 attacks and Iraq. 9/11 was being used as a way to get through some policies that the Bush administration had been wanting to do for a long time, which was invade Iraq. So they used this as an excuse to terrible consequences. And Tsai gets this tip. He talks to this general and first learns about Abu Ghraib, and he's being told about torture. And then he gets a second tip from somebody who's working for 60 Minutes, who also is onto this story, and they have evidence of torture. But 60 Minutes is getting pressure from the government not to publish their story. Tsai runs with it, and through his reporting, he uncovers the Taguba report, which was a general was assigned to look into Abu Ghraib and found that torture had happened. And so, yes, Tsai broke this story, which redefined this war.
And part of what helped redefine the war were the pictures that he helped publish in The New Yorker.
Exactly.
And there's a remarkable story in your film about how he was able to solicit the source that gave him those pictures. And, you know, not to be too corny about it, but public media plays a role in this. Is that fair
totally.
To say?
Yeah. Two whistleblowers are sources for this. The first one is Joseph Darby, who was in the unit and had access to the photos. After the first story broke, Tsai goes on to Diane Rehm's show and says,
get in touch with me, 202-872-0703. Just call, leave a number, I'll get in touch with you.
And he gets a call that afternoon, and a woman says, you need to come see me. He goes and visits her, and she says, I have this laptop that my daughter-in-law came back with Iraq, and it has photos. And there was additional photos, the use of dogs to torture a prisoner. I mean, they're horrifying photos. And this was somebody who was so terrified of coming forward and speaking to a journalist that she didn't even tell her closest family that she had talked to Tsai until actually we started working on the film.
Wow.
She agreed to talk to us. And when we were setting up cameras, she had to pull her husband aside and say, this is why there's cameras here, you know. In 2004, I talked to Cy Hirsch.
This is 20 years later.
Yeah.
She had kept this as a secret from her family.
She was scared about the repercussion, and she was right to be scared, because what we've learned is that the only people that are often held accountable for abuse of power are people who expose it. You know, Joseph Darby was subjected to horrible retribution, and yet the people who created the framework for this system of torture are allowed to walk.
You're speaking to the incredible risks taken, in some cases by investigative reporters, but most of all by their sources. And of course, the relationship between a reporter and his or her sources is one of the most sacred in journalism. You were able to get a remarkable amount of access to Cy Hirsch's notebooks and files. These are yellow notepads we see over and over throughout your film. These are notes taken in the reporting process, in some cases filled with names and numbers of people who to this day he has protected. He allowed you to have a deeply intimate look at his life and his professional career. How did you pull that off?
Again, he trusted us. I mean, he'd worked with Mark before, the co-director. He knew my work. Anything he shared with us, we were going to treat with utmost care in terms of source protection. And yet he was still nervous.
He freaked out.
He freaked out.
There's a moment where he sees a notepad that you're handling and he says,
"What the f- is this doing in your hands? You know, this is an FBI guy, but most of them are CIA guys."
"I don't think we're in a position at any point, or we're intending at any point."
"Well, I'd like to quit
any of these people."
"So I'd like to quit."
And you know,
it sounds like this was not the only time that this happened. How did you bring him back?
"I know what I'm doing in terms of source protection." He came back and trusted us. For me, it was very important to include it in the film because the stakes are real. It's the most sacred thing, the relationship between a journalist and their source.
You clearly have a lot of respect for him and for his journalism over the years. That said, you did not shy away from a pattern of mistakes that he's made over the years.
It was important to me that we have to tackle size stories where he got it wrong. For me, it was really important to talk about Syria because I had friends who were tortured in Syria by Assad, and he knows very well that I have criticisms about that reporting.
You're referring to a 2013 piece in the London Review of Books in which Hirsch scrutinizes the Obama administration's narrative that Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. He wrote, "Barack Obama did not tell the whole story this autumn when he tried to make the case that Bashar al-Assad was responsible for the chemical weapons attack near Damascus on the 21st of August. Later on, however, it was revealed that Assad's regime was responsible for the attack." And you challenged him about this in the film.
I read this stuff now and I say to myself, I really misjudged him. I saw him two or three or four times and I didn't think he was capable of doing what he did. Period. And let's call that wrong. Let's call that very much wrong.
Is that an example of getting too close to power?
Of course. What else is it? I never thought he was Mother Teresa, but I thought he was okay. But if I have made a claim in prior interviews to be perfect, I would now withdraw it. That's all. I wasn't perfect.
This is hard to wrap my head around as a viewer because you have documented a long career defined by his deep skepticism of power and really lifting up the victims of state violence. So what do you make of this contradiction? How did he fall into this trap?
I mean, I share exactly your perspective on this. How is it possible, given his body of work and where he's consistently taking a position against power? Again, only Cy can speak to that, right? But I knew that I needed to ask it in the film.
Another example of your skepticism of his sourcing was his 2023 bombshell report on Substack about the Nord Stream pipeline. This is the pipeline which had allowed Russia to transport gas to the EU. In 2022, there was mysterious explosions that damaged the pipeline, and Hirsch wrote a piece alleging that the CIA had collaborated with Norway to blow it up. You asked Hirsch about his decision to base this piece on a single source. In response to that, he says,
"So what? So what? I mean, so legitimate criticism, absolutely. You know, right?
Say more.
Yeah. What do I mean?
I mean, it is a legitimate.
But the only point I'm saying is that
of course, there was, what am I going to do? I can't write about who I know else was brought in from the Army, the Air Force, because I'm exposing them. Even if there's 9 sources, sometimes it's much better just to make it 1. I'm sorry to tell you that. Well, because you don't know, you don't want to talk, you don't want about sources in the State Department and the CIA both agree.
What if the source didn't, got it wrong, and it's a single source? What do you do?
Then I've got 20 years of working with the guy that I've been wrong on. Time after time, I'm told things that turn out to be right.
Relying on a single source is very dangerous, and it's something that I feel critical of and felt that there's this kind of skepticism that need to be brought into the film. I think there's still a lot we don't know about what happened with the Nord Stream sabotage, but there have been a lot of journalists who have reported a very different narrative.
One thing that fascinated me about the film is, of course, he's getting called nasty names by Richard Nixon. There are examples of other journalists who are critical of him as a reporter and some of his tactics. Then there's the scrutiny that he gets from the public. We see him on C-SPAN taking callers, and it's clear that throughout his career, there was a segment of the population that didn't support what he was doing, that didn't actually want to see the truth that he was trying to reveal.
Right. I mean, that's what the film is all about, right? To ask the hard questions in the moment when the stakes are the highest. He got a lot of pushback because there was a kind of march to war. If you're looking at Vietnam or if you're looking at Iraq, we have a consensus looking back in history that both of these wars were catastrophes, right? But in the moment, that's not the narrative that we were being told, and that the legacy media in large part we're telling the public, right? This is what the crux of the whole film is that we have to be asking those questions. Otherwise, we're going to keep repeating these patterns.
Right now, with the Trump administration, we're seeing what I hope is not the beginning of a potential new march to war with Venezuela. The stakes for good national security reporting remain extremely high. At the same time, it's getting harder and harder for legitimate investigative reporters to do their work. Spaces like the Pentagon and the White House that were once more open to journalists to do work. Mm-hmm. I see you shaking your head.
I'm going to push back a little. I don't think the problem is investigative journalists. I think the problem is government lying and institutions not backing investigative journalists. And I don't think journalists are going to find the truth at Pentagon press briefings. I'm sorry. Like, I just don't think that's where truth is going to be found. I mean, that's where lies are going to be. You know, this is so I believe investigative journalists will continue to fight and continue to actually risk their lives, which is what we're seeing around the world. Journalists going to prison, journalists being assassinated. Journalists are willing to fight for the truth. The question I have is about the institutional support for that work and the willingness to take on the government when they come after you. So currently, I'm very concerned about the capitulation of large media organizations to government pressure, both the settlement around 60 Minutes and Paramount and ABC not fighting for the First Amendment, I think is the biggest threat we're seeing. And that's coming from institutions, not from journalists doing their jobs.
You do believe that in the lead up to some of our wars, mainstream journalists were too credulous.
They were cheerleading.
I'd like to know what you think journalists can learn from the film and from reporters like Cy Hirsch.
Right. I mean, I think we need to use the words to describe what we're seeing. I'll go back to Cy's reporting around torture. When he reported about Abu Ghraib, there were editorial guidelines in the legacy institutions not to use the word torture to describe CIA torture, right? That they're supposed to use enhanced interrogation techniques. It's the job of journalists to be adversarial and to report the facts as they see them, regardless of the consequences, without fear or favor. What we're seeing in Gaza, I mean, how can we look at a population that's being starved and civilians being bombed for 2 years and not call it a genocide? I mean, I just think we have to use the words that we know to describe what is happening. The erosion of trust in the media is because the public often feels lied to. They feel lied to by their government, and they feel that the press is also part of the lying.
Laura Poitras is an investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker. Her latest film, Cover Up, is playing in select theaters and will stream on Netflix later this month. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Molly Rosen, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Candace Wong. Travis Mannin is our video producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Michael Loewinger.
The Sam Sanders Show is coming up next, along with news updates from NPR and KQED. Support for KQED comes from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, presenting Georgiana and Kitty, Christmas at Pemberley. This holiday sequel to Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice performs through December 28th at Palo Alto's Lucy Stern Theater. Info at TheaterWorks.org. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. We also have a traffic update. There's a crash in Oakland. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hello there, Beth. You're stuck in heavy traffic in Oakland, eastbound 580 after Park Boulevard. A solo vehicle crash has taken away the right shoulder, and a blitz of slowing driving into San Francisco on the upper deck of the Bay Bridge. You're clogging up from the incline to 101. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. This is KQED.